Ian Kelly, welcome to Talks with Tony. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the podcast.
Thank you for
and attacking the London network traffic. Horrific. Yeah, it's all right. We're here, safe. So you were just saying being, you know, you're not from South London, so you call it south of the river.
Everything south of the river is harder to get to. Yeah, absolutely. It's always been, even since I was a kid. You could drive and park in London then, and everything in the south of the river, even though there's a crow flies, it's not very far. It felt like it was miles away. It was always the toughest place to get to.
Well, I appreciate you making the effort. Yeah. So for those people who don't know you, I know a lot of people when they do a podcast will always go, take you back to the beginning. We'll always get there. But I want people who don't yet know you because you do a lot on certain circles, certain social profiles, but a lot of it, you're not posting tons out there. So there might be a lot of people who need to know what you've got to say, but don't actually hear you. Yeah. So for those people who don't know, how would you intro yourself?
How do I intro myself? Probably serial entrepreneur, because that's what I've been doing. I've built and sold businesses, all in the recruitment space. I've invested in businesses. I'm invested in a food company. I'm invested in a streaming company in America. I'm invested in a new SaaS scaffolding company. I knew nothing about scaffolding, but apparently when you put scaffolding up in London, because all the buildings are different shapes, you need to know wind direction, and the businesses need these teams to come in and design it and all this type of stuff. So I've invested in a SaaS business that will do that.
So the SaaS funds the
SaaS is a software as a service. So it's a software. So it aggregates all of the designs that get uploaded into this system, and then it will give you a template. So it cuts out 75% of the work.
Wow.
And it will do Google Maps, and it will tell you which way the wind blows, and it will do all this sort of stuff. So it's very new.
Yeah.
But it's going to get there. So that was something a little bit left side. YPT, which is an app, takes your bloods and does your health, and they've got a contract with the American Army, invest in that. So they're all a little bit sides.
Very diverse.
I get people come to me, but I've only ever lost money in things like hedge funds, private. Generally, the only money I've ever really lost of any scale was when I was doing investments with UBS, because they sell to each other. It's a little echo chamber. They believe it's going to be this, that, and the other, and it's just rubbish. So I then after that, I decided I'm going to stick to things either I understand really in depth, or I can get, if I had to roll my sleeves up and jump in, I can help out. With the scaffolding business, it was, I know the previous CTO, I know one of the main investors, because I invested in his company, which he sold for just shy of $100 million in August last year, which I was his initial investor.
Wow.
So I invested in his company, I know the CTO, and then I've got a mate who's a director of a very large construction company. So I rang him up and I said, do you know anything about scaffolding? And I know loads about scaffolding. And I said, good, because I know nothing. Sent him the deck. And he's like, well, we can't do it. And I said, no, because it's a new product. What it's telling you it's going to do, it doesn't do yet. But let's get you in. So I got him in as an advisor, and then he's invested. And so that helps as well. But other than that, it's always been recruitment companies, predominantly the public sector.
Yep.
So I've done a lot of public sector, government, children's services, medical, predominantly education. I was an IT recruiter to start off with. I did start off training to be a surveyor and selling shops and offices in Camden.
It's a completely different world.
And, I didn't enjoy it. I've never seen such miserable people as surveyors. And I carry around all their stuff under their arm, reading the Estates Gazette and going, ooh, and they hated their jobs. So I thought, I'm not going to do this. And then kind of fell into it. No one plans to do recruitment. You just fall into it. And then rolled that on. Sold a few businesses, come out of I ran a PLC when I was 30, came out of that in 2015, had 3 years out of the market, did some investments and stuff, but was in touch with my old boss from 98, who's quite a big character himself. He's Kate Middleton's uncle. He's got his own little podcast now, Pints of View.
Pints of View, what a fabulous name for a podcast.
He's a high-functioning alcoholic, he'll openly say it himself, but it's a pub in Marylebone. And he just has his mates in and has chat. I was the first one, so
I love it.
Yeah, you should look it up. He's quite mental, but he's highly intelligent and he's very funny.
He sounds like my kind. I've actually been following him for a long time on LinkedIn.
Gary.
Do you know the way you find like you follow a lot of different people because somebody else does. And my husband kind of sits in the background of our business. Although, so where you're talking about, you know, surveyors being the most miserable people, we invest in property. We've done that for the last 8 or 9 years. And we have to make friends with some of these miserable people because we want them on our side. Yeah. I'm a HR manager by trade. Oh, so I did a lot of recruitment and training. And I'm so sorry. I'm reformed.
It used to stand for hates recruitment. You know.
Human remains is what they used to call it in my office. Yeah. Human remains. People would only knock on your door if they had a problem or if they had an issue. And I think, you know, those backgrounds, isn't it bizarre how all of those things come together? But yeah, I find that the reason I run this podcast, the reason I'm relaunching it after a 2-year hiatus, I fell out of love with it. I'm a public speaking teacher. That's what I do. Yeah. And you mentioned before we started rolling, Rob Moore.
Yeah.
So I am a public speaking trainer on his companies. Okay, I'm a property trainer for his company, Progressive Property. And I had zero idea that I was ever going to do any of that. But that side of it is you build this network up. And I thought, I'm meeting all of these amazing people.
Mm.
And I love the conversational style of a podcast. Why not just meet more and more people? So, that's why we
I mean, I chat for a living. I'm a recruiter. So that's what we
This
what
is
we
what
do.
I love. So we need to kind of get into the this is you now. Mm. And you've been very, very humble about your achievements there. You know, run a PLC when I was 30. How does a boy who, and I've, you know, done a lot of reading around you to find your own words. I'm going to go back to the boy.
Record,
Listen, I'm a scouser, we can do this stuff. Yeah. But in your own words, you classified yourself as a failed boxer and a failed footballer with a handful of GCSEs. Mm. How does a young man from London then create this new persona, you know, still the real you? And what I love about you is that even on your socials, it's still this is me, take me as you find me. How do you then go from, you know, did you go to a standard state school?
No, I didn't. I did go to a state school, but I didn't go to a standard state school.
Moved out of area.
If I'd had my choice back in the day, I would have just gone to the local school, the comprehensive with all my friends. 70-80% end up in prison in their, you know, late teens, early 20s. So that was probably, even though I didn't really enjoy my time at school, because I went to a very posh school, I went to what is now the top school in the country.
Right.
And I played games like Eton Fives. So Eton Fives is it's a pairs game, it's in this concrete like shed
with
buttress sticks out, and you play Eton, Winchester, rugby, you know,
all the top schools.
You play all these top schools. And even though it's quite actually, it's generally a game for quite long-limbed, tall people, a bit like tennis and stuff, because you've got to reach. And I'm obviously quite short and short-limbed and just not the right shape for that type of stuff. But I boxed. So I had quite a whip to my arm and I was very good. And I really enjoyed the game. It was fantastic. But I used to, I'd go on a Saturday and you'd have to take your PE kit at my school in a duffel, like it's a duffel bag with a D chain on it, and you always had to have a briefcase. You got a Saturday morning detention if your top button was undone. It was, you know, it was a very academic school, but it also back then, not so much now, it's changed a bit. It was a rugby only school, so you weren't even allowed to play football.
And football had been your passion as a child.
It kind of been my passion. I'd enjoyed boxing and football. My dad's football bonkers, and he kind of pushed me because I got picked up by Chelsea and he pushed me to their school of excellence. I kind of realised when I got there I probably wasn't good enough. And I was in awe of the confidence of a lot of people as well.
Yeah.
In terms of these youngsters really believed they were the best players in the world. I just knew I was good amongst my mates and locally in the local county. But then you go there and you see some fantastic kids. But, you know, we stuck the time out there. But I went to QE Boys in Barnet. I think it's 7 miles as a crow flies from my house, but that meant the way the roads work in London, going out of London, in London, it was about an hour and a half to get there, generally, because you had to change buses and trains. And if I missed the bus home, it would take me from leaving school about 2 and a bit hours.
Wow.
Even though it's 7 miles. And so I would come back, and if I got on the double-decker bus, I would pass two comprehensive schools where, you know, these are proper state London schools. And I would sit on the back of the bus on my own. All my mates would sit down below. They'd get off way before me because they get off in the posh area.
Mm-hmm.
And I was seen then. It was all right in the first couple of 2 to 3 years of school because, you know, I'd been a local boxer in the area. I played football. I knew a lot of these kids. But then, you know, puberty happens and kids get bigger. And then suddenly you get into stuff you shouldn't be into. Well, they would see me as, you know, come onto my estate and they'd see me as a posh kid. and I go to school and they see me as a poor kid. So you're never really fitting in either. And I had good friends on both sides. I think the main lesson I got from that was I sat next to kids who, back then, you know, parents drove BMWs and Mercedes, much more affluent cars than they are today.
Yeah.
Right? You know, you had a few quid if you could do that. My mum had a Skoda Vestel, the one with the little engine in the back. Right? And it was the only brand new car we'd ever had. And people used to take the mickey out. And I didn't care. It was a long way to school, right? Give me a lift home, you know. I never hid where I was from. And it took until I was 16 for one of my friends at school to come to my estate.
Wow.
Yeah. So there were kids who weren't even allowed to catch the bus through where I lived because it was that kind of place, right? But you don't notice that when you live there. You don't really
see
it.
It's all you know, isn't it?
It's all you know.
You know all the rough people? Yeah. You say hello to them. Well, you're speaking to the converted here. I'm from Liverpool.
You do, but then when you get older, when you start to get, you know, married and that type of stuff, you realise you don't know the scallywags that are the real scallywags. You might know the people who are still in contact with stuff, but you know, that's why we moved out of London. But it was one of those, I would always stand my ground and I was always, you know, be who I was. And I think a lot of my friends at school who were wealthy, but, you know, liked that about me. But they got two arms and two legs, might be taller, shorter, whatever. There was no reason I couldn't do as well as they were going to do.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of time, again, we used to call it in IDB, into daddy's business. But it was like that.
It has a literal three-letter acronym for it, IDB.
IDB. Because we've seen years later and, you know, how you do it. I think my school at the time, the way the demographics changed now, it's very Asian, was probably 50% in a year group was Jewish.
Really?
And it was quite, because where I was from in North London was a very Jewish area. And so I had loads of Jewish mates growing up and there was lots of Greek kids there as well because just it was a bit of that affluence. And
it's really diverse.
Yeah. So, but then, you know, my estate, where I was from, you know, we were talking about early Irish families and, you know, I used to go out in Cricklewood where the Galtee Moor was and stuff like that. That was where, you know, the vans would drive down on a morning and pick up a navvy and go and do day's work. And now if you go there, it's Eastern Europeans and Somalians. Mm. The whole demographics changed.
Yeah.
When on my estate, it was generally, you know, London families, second generation Irish, and black families. And that was it. And it just, the whole thing, and it just, time changes, you know. So you grow up in what I thought was a diverse community, but it's probably not as diverse as it is today.
Diverse for the time.
Yeah.
What I absolutely love about all of this is that many people would have, like, first of all, we need to kind of go, why did your parents send you to that school? You know, were they concerned that you would turn out a certain way because they'd seen the other kids in the area? That's a huge decision for parents to make, and being a parent yourself, I'm a parent myself, you know, that dilemma over which school do you send the kids to, that, you know, you want them to be themselves, but also not be a different variation. Yeah. I love the fact that you've mentioned that, you know, around your mates, you were still your mates in the local estate, but you'd never really cared. Has that been something that was instilled in you from being a child, who you are?
It's a tough one because my sister went to Henrietta Barnett. So it was me, my sister, my brother. Brother went to the same school as me. My sister went to Henrietta Barnett, which is the top girls' school in the country, in Hampstead. And she, you know, she was highly academic, highly intelligent when she was younger. And she went there with very different people in the, you know, my dad would always moan at me, you never read books. I read so many books now. My wife's just had a go at me recently. She's going to build in my office at home a new book cabinet because there's books everywhere.
Too many books.
And because I read three or four books at once.
Yeah.
And because I get bored halfway through a book because these aren't novels and these aren't love stories. And so I don't know. I've always been me because even from a young age, before we talked about Clubhouse and the sound bites and these little things, I always thought, if I'm not going to be me, who's going to be me? And I was never trying to be anyone else because I couldn't be anyone else. And I just thought, whatever happens to me is what happens to me because, you know, I'm never a victim of anything. You know, I'm my own person. And I've had lots of crap things happen to me in my life, especially when I was younger. You know, got stabbed in the bum. You know, I've had knives put to my throat, got shot at. I had a whole, a gang after me. And, you know,
this was from the area that you lived in.
It was. It was like, basically, it all started when I was about 14. And on my estate, I had a friend I used to play cricket with. Because, again, I played cricket. Not many kids in my estate play cricket. And used to knock in cricket bats. And so at the back of my the kind of terrace where we lived, there was a bit of grass and there was this thing called a child guidance centre with bars where they put all the naughty children. And so there was a bit of grass there and I said, well, we'll go and knock in a cricket bat. And then two lads. I knew them from around the area. They were kind of, you know, when you've got areas, when you live on estates, when you're young, the other side of the estate now doesn't look very far away, but it was always another group or another
a big
gang.
Road, a different, yeah. different group of people.
That's what they call postcodes now. And you go into prisons, which postcode are you from? Mate of mine was explaining this to me a few years ago. And he was knocking in this, and I was bowling a cricket ball and he's knocking it back and, you know. And these a couple of lads, a bit older than us, come over and they pushed my mate and they took the cricket bat and come and shorty, bowl at me, you know, blah, 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 give me a few words about, you know, what I look like. And I thought, do you know what, I'm going to bowl a little bit faster. And I bowled and hit him on the ankle. And my mate laughed and he attacked my mate with this bat and he started, because that's who they'd come for, my mate. I don't know what it was over. So they attacked
me with
the bat.
So there was something already there and they weren't just happening upon you.
The bit where they act like they're not going to do anything. And it was so, I could sense there was something going on. I just didn't know who they were. And then, so I ran down and he hit me on the arm and then hit me, I lost it. And I beat this guy to a pulp, beat him unconscious, beat his mate. And I was covered in quite a bit of blood as well. I was only about 14, 15 years old, but it was the rage that came out of me. Mm. And I boxed as well. So,
yeah, you
know,
so you
I
had the skill.
Punch and, you know, I'm only a little lad, but the temper had gone. And my friend said to me, you need to go. He said, do you know who their dad is? And I was like, I've got no idea. And being cocky, I was like, I don't care.
Yeah.
So I went down and I remember looking out the back of my sister's bedroom window and there was probably about 20 young lads from my age up to about 18 or 19 who'd arrived, maybe 17, 18, arrived outside the little bit patch outside my house. And my dad's like, what are you looking at? What are you looking at? And I was like, well, all these boys out here, what happened? Told him what happened. So my dad gets a claw hammer and a baseball bat.
I like
my
your
dad's
dad.
Little. He's smaller than me and he's out there. My dad had been a boxer as well. He goes out there. And look, if you're getting rushed by that many people, you're not going to do anything. But he said, look, what's going on? And one of the guys at the front said, he hit my sister. My dad said, are you sure you didn't hit the people at the back with the blood on their face? And there was a bit of umming and ahhing and people saying stuff and calling names. And my dad said, look, one-on-one, anyone, and it's over. We don't want to see any more of it from today. I'm like, crap in my pants. Because there's kids that are, you know, older than me, bigger than me. I know will wipe the floor with me. But no one took the offer. Mainly because obviously, I'd done something in rage, you know, because I'd been attacked and stuff like that. But that continued. So basically, I'd upset a gang or these families from my local area. And my cousin, who was my best mate, was from about 4 miles away. But he was in another estate. And I was friendly with them because it was, you know, I used to see him more. So then, you know, it just kind of became tit for tat over the next few years. And we was at parties where you see two groups going, we live 4 miles away from each other, right? And then it's just like suddenly people turn up at parties with bats and... And I've never really subscribed to any of that. I don't want to be involved in that. My friends, a lot of them were up to stuff they shouldn't be up to. I just didn't go along for that ride. It was never me. I always felt internally I was a little bit different. Definitely was a lot sharper than a lot of my mates. And I was always wheeling and dealing. I used to sell all the fake Ralph Lauren and Armani jeans. And
from what age is this?
I was wheeling and dealing from like 16, 17, outwardly. Before that, I'd always work as well. I've always had jobs from when I was younger. And I was always doing things like that. I was always making money and doing stuff. So again, I was always seen as the one with a few quid. I always had the nicest cars, bought a house when I was 20. Didn't live in it until I got married. It was my right to buy a council house, my granddad's. So I bought my granddad's house, mainly because he kept getting his letters. He was a secure tenant, but it used to leave him in tears.
Yeah.
And it was only him and this 3-bedroom, 70-detached house in London, 100-foot garden and a garage.
That he'd probably paid for a million times over for renting it from the council for so many years.
Absolutely.
Exactly the same story with my family.
They were really trying to push him out for family. And he would, I'd go around and he'd be in tears about it. So when I was 19, 20, I got into property and I explained to him, you know, where he was a secure tenant. He'd been in there pre-74, 76, whenever it was. But it used to upset him because they were really harsh to counsel him, pushing his letters. But they never said, we will remove you. But they were kind of...
It was enough for him to be worried.
And I thought, just not going to have that. And I was talking to my financial advisor. See, I took a pension out when I was 18. Right,
that's just unheard of.
I know, he still talks about it now. He's 10 years older than me, but he still talks about, I tell to people about your story. And I just felt I wanted to do things that other people weren't doing. So I looked into pensions and it was just, I used to read the FT.
And was this something that was instilled in you? You know, no, your parents were reading no. it?
My dad read The Sun and The Mirror every day.
Even as a Liverpool fan, he read The Sun.
Oh no, this was years ago, pre that. But my dad was, things about schooling, going back to that question about schooling, my dad's got A-level physics, maths and English, right? And
he's a smart
10 O-levels, and he's a bright man. And the year before, normal state school, year before that, he was off a year with bronchitis from school. And so he's an intelligent man, but back then he didn't know what to do with that stuff. Mm-hmm. So he became an electrician like his dad was an electrician. And he's always been, and the thing I love my dad to bits, but my dad's social circle and his football club and his chairman and his this, that, and that, for me, that always felt really safe. You can be the smartest in that little group, and that's the comfort zone for you. Yeah. And all he ever wanted was, you know, a nice house for him and his family, or just enough, and then play his football and this and that. And that's cool. But that was, and he's always worked for himself as well. Yeah. So I had that kind of influence, that entrepreneurial influence. Yeah. My old chairman did a talk for one of my groups a few weeks ago, and he's really into entrepreneurs and stuff. Luke Johnson, he sold Pizza Express. He owns. He was famous for losing 160 million personal wealth overnight in Patisserie Valerie.
Oh my word!
Yeah, chairman of Channel 4 when I brought him on as my chairman. So he's used to writing the FT, used to writing the Times and stuff. He's a very intelligent man, and when he speaks, he's just someone you want to listen to because he's got lots to say. And he was just explaining that it's like something like 90% of entrepreneurs had an influence where they had someone at home who was an entrepreneur or worked for themselves, or they had a very close family member or one of their friends' parents. But generally, when they've looked at all the studies, they had some sort of influence of why they would go and do that themselves.
The whole rich dad, poor dad thing, you didn't have it, but I found it elsewhere. And there's so many things that you've just said there. That, you know, we were talking before we hit record earlier on about how, you know, Liverpool fan and my choice was you're a Liverpool fan or you're homeless. Yeah. Our family's originally from Liverpool, prior to that from Ireland. And everything that you're saying there, you're kind of about your dad. Yeah. You are literally talking about my dad. He was a plasterer because his dad was a plasterer. He's the smartest man I've ever met. Mm-hmm. But he had these constraints around him. In so much
but
as
also you don't know what you don't know. You don't. The university back then was seen for wealthy people, and whatever.
What it was that, never on the cards.
No.
So super smart.
Just don't get it, did I?
But even the year in bronchitis off, my dad hadn't. You know, he might have been one of the smartest people, but he was also dumb. In, as many of us are as kids, they used to do this thing when they were kids. Because my dad's 87 now, used to jump on the back of wagons and hold on to them to move to the next place, and then they'd move to the next one, and he fell, and he was dragged along a road from top to bottom of a really big street in Liverpool that he used to live on, and he's got. You know, severe. Oh, he had severe burns and gravel down his back, skin grafts galore, but was in hospital for over a year. But during that time in hospital for over a year, it must have been a nightmare for the nurses and the doctors, was that he just continually asked questions. He learned a lot about medicine, even though he's never studied it. He wanted to know something about everything. So where you're saying this entrepreneur, because I'm pretty much the only entrepreneur, and my dad's, you know, worked in his own company. My elder brother took it over, but there was always challenges. They were builders in the day when Macmillan went bust, and, you know, they remortgage their own house to pay for other people. But I love that you've, because many people would have gone, oh, this is the life that's set for me. Your mum and dad must have had this idea that they wanted something more for the three of you as well.
I wanted something more. My dad's, it's very much like, you know, wherever you are with what goes on, you know, people call me a conspiracy theorist. I like that you wear your tin hat. and, you know, I research heavily the stuff that I talk about. But, you know, I find the critical thinkers are generally those people who are inquisitive and they've got inquisitive minds. They're asking questions. They want to know things. They're not easily brainwashed. And my dad, he used to get this natural science magazine. So he was always into these things. And my dad loved history. So he would talk about history and stuff. And he was very challenging as well in conversation. To the point, actually, as he's got older, he just rubs everybody up the wrong way. Mm-hmm. Because whatever your point is, he's going to... coming on the other side, and he's like that. So he can be difficult in a situation, I think, more as he got older. But he pushed us to go to the schools we went to, not because he knew that this was a path. I think as a dad or a mum, you're like, you know, be a surveyor, be a doctor,
you're
be a lawyer,
best.
You know, just go into something safe. I mean, when I went off to start my own businesses, he tried to talk me out of it. He tried to talk me out of going into, when I went in to be a commercial negotiator and studied, did this distance learning, Reading to be a surveyor. I basically applied for a surveyor's job, which I didn't have the qualifications to do. But I'd already applied and been accepted for this thing. And I'd worked for William Hill doing their property management on their all their leaseholds and stuff around London. So I'd kind of been around the surveyors as well. So I thought, well, I'll, you know what, I'll go.
So it was about the network. On the TV in the background the other night, I'm in a hotel room doing some work. I always need background noise and I listen to a podcast. And on the TV was Catch Me If You Can. It's, right, yeah, you know, yeah, a very yeah. much tamer version. Yeah, but you applied for a job that you weren't officially qualified for.
Oh, God, I used to do that I had an epiphany when I was about 21. And I decided to change my life. There's a thing on LinkedIn, actually, that I wrote about 10 targets I put down. People say to me, did you get that from a book? I'd never read any book. I just thought, my best friend and my cousin went to prison. And I thought, do you know what? I just don't want to go down this line. I'm worth more than this. And I sat down and I wrote these 10 things down.
And this was at about 21?
About 20, coming up 21. I don't know whether about 21. I think I was about 21 and I'd written these things down, but then I started like buying the FT and I started buying the Times and I didn't really understand all of what was going on. I've even got a book, I've still got it at home, How to Read the FT. So that was the first book I bought, was How to Read the FT to understand it and things like that. So I still wasn't really getting it because sometimes you need someone to explain it to you. I mean, the book was like
that. Yeah, and you never had like a mentor or
one at all. My dad could never answer any of those questions for me. But that was me. I was trying to join the dots in my brain. But I used to then apply. Is it my years ago? My old business partner, I was telling him about it, and he just found it hysterical. But I'd apply for like a non-executive director role at BP.
like a 2021 with no experience.
Yeah, I'd send these letters off, and I tell you what happened. The first one I did, I thought, you know, have these moments where you're a dreamer when you're younger.
Yeah.
And I was like, maybe they'll look at that and they'll go, do you know what? We need to give this lad a chance. You know, he could be brilliant for us. Knew nothing about business, knew nothing about anything.
I love
stuff.
That.
And I used to get these letters back from HR. So HR would have a standard block letter that they would send you back and say, Dean, thank you very much for your application. We're going to keep your details on file. You've not been successful this time, blah, blah, blah. And I used to go, winning, right? Because I used to think in my head that they'd seen my CV and thought, do you know what?
He's one for the future. I love that.
So it used to buoy me up. And then I got into this point and I wrote these 10 things down. And I wrote on LinkedIn when I was 45 or something, I wrote in there that I'd done 9 by the time I was 30, which was when I was aiming to do them for. And the last one of them on there was that I would be invited to number 10 by whoever the Prime Minister was. And that didn't happen until I was 40.
Oh, you failed. Yeah.
But that was the whole point of the thing was just because you missed it, it doesn't mean you can't catch up. Right. And I had all these things, but I looked at them, you know, heavily for 2 weeks and then kind of they drifted into the background. But I achieved all those goals just subliminally. They were in my back of my mind.
Yeah. So do you believe in that? Do you believe in the law of attraction? How much of it is action? How much is goal setting and actually physically documenting things down? Because although you never had like a mentor or a coach at that time, you now obviously mentor and coach lots of other people. So how much of it was, you know, putting a goal down on paper?
I think you always got to put stuff down on paper if you use it or don't use it. I'm a big believer. If your brain tells your hand what to write, you write it. Your eyes see it, it goes in, it stores in the back of your brain, right? Mm. It becomes a memory. I write all the time when I'm on the phone talking to someone. I was saying to someone this morning, actually, but I'd written some notes yesterday and I can't even read them. Then my handwriting's so bad. I should have been a doctor.
just applied for it and got the job anyway.
It. Handwriting's rubbish. We give him a job.
Neurosurgeon in the making.
I think when you don't know what to do and you're faced with a massive brick wall, you can do what a lot of people do. And I'd say 90% of the population is they just get in their groove and do whatever their lot is.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can look at it and go, right, I'm going to take that down brick at a time. And that's how I looked at it. I was like, well, I just don't know. I don't know what a bigger world is. My parents can't help me in that because they've not been exposed to it. And I just kind of methodically worked through different things and I joined dots. I worked in lots of lovely houses with my dad, like in Bishop's Avenue and places like that. And I'd say to him, what do they do? Who does this? And he always used to say to me, people who work in offices are lazy. And I remember years later when I sold my first business, so I was out having a drink with him. And I said to him, why did you used to say people? I said, I go into the city. I mean, I get on a train at 5 a.m. right? And I get off the train at 9:38 p.m. in the evening, right? And I said, I work and I do these businesses. And I said, and I said, I'm not the only person on that train. There are loads of people on that train. I said, when I leave the city of the evening, there's people in those offices. I'm talking about the heart of the city. And I said, and I've never seen people work so hard. They might not be labouring and lifting stuff up. And I've done that. I've worked on building sites, right? You can do all that. And that is, it's a physical fatigue. But that mental fatigue leaves you physically fatigued. Mm. And the stress and everything else that goes with that. And he was like, well, and it's like, you know, fluorescent lights, I put them up in offices. And he said, you know, there'll be women there doing their nails in the secretarial pool. And I was like, how does that equate to the entire city? That you put some things up, you see some people doing their nails. It's like, but it's a that snapshot. Was his exposure to yeah. it. Right. And so you don't know. So you have to then think about where, you know, I remember walking into Boots, into the business section, and that's where I bought that book, How to Read the FT. And then I thought, I'll buy that. I'll learn how to read the FT and I'll read the FT. Because it was a bit us and them back then.
Yeah.
You know, I remember, don't know if you remember Graham Lasso, the footballer, that he got all these disparaging remarks because he turned up and everyone else was reading The Sun and he read the FT.
I love that. So I think as part of this, have you always known, because you mentioned earlier on, you've always known you were a little bit different. There are many people now. Mm. Who are in the same boat, but they want to be, you know, mainstream. I've always been a little bit weird. I've never been entrepreneurial. Yeah. I was dragged along to an event by my husband who wanted to invest in property. I bought a house in 2007, height of the market, paid far too much for it in Chester, moving out of Liverpool because I was working there and I got moved around store to store because I was in retail in HR. And then bought a house in 2007. The market, you know, the bottom fell out of the market. I was stuck with this house in negative equity. My then boyfriend had moved on to Bristol, so I was stuck with this issue. So if you fast forward, met my husband, who then goes, we should invest in property. And the reason being, so he's always been a little bit entrepreneurial, but I think he's always had the fear. And when you've not got people around you, go on, I believe in you, or in your case, your dad saying, I'm not sure you should do this.
Most people told me not to do it. I mean, that's... I was the kid, if you said, don't jump off that, I jumped off it, you know.
Figure out.
Yeah, it's just, it was probably a bad thing to tell me I can't do something or I wasn't going to be something or, you know, that because my Gary Goldsmith, my business partner in the network, I mean, we've got 300 CEOs there. I've run an online event with 40 of them yesterday. He always says to me, you're very balanced, Dean. You've got a big chip on each shoulder. and that's probably right.
It served you well.
So far.
We're going to touch on these achievements because mine was that I was dragged along. I don't think I've ever had like entrepreneurial spirit. And then when you look back, it's where you say these memories. So in school, I went to an all-girls Catholic high school taught by nuns, you know, with the woolen blazer and everyone had roller skirts up to a certain length and roll them back down when the teachers came by. But I used to braid people's hair. Never been a hairdresser, but I was good at doing hair. And I used to charge people to do their hair during a break. So I suppose I was always a bit entrepreneurial. But we're not nurturing it. There was no one around me to go, that's a really good idea.
School's not built for that.
I'd love to touch upon education because I know it's a sector that you're in. You know, if we look at last year, what, five education secretaries in 4 months.
It's all theatre. It's all theatre. I mean, schools are moan whether they're Labour or Conservative or whatever else.
Yep.
And I think that's because schools... I mean, the whole structure of government's wrong. Government's far too big.
Yep.
It's people, the wrong people get into there. As Milton Friedman said, you know, it attracts men of a poor stamp. and it does. It very, very badly. The narcissists, they get bought. They get owned by corporates and elites and whatever else. And
it's a face
fit.
You
can't get to the top unless you're corrupt. And you might not want to be corrupt for there, but you are.
Or might not start corrupt.
You might not start corrupt. But you'll either get whipped out if you're not. They'll find something on you. And I think also in politics, it doesn't matter anymore. There's no left and right. It's all theatre. You know, we're the audience. They're the actors. You pay to see the best actor, and that's the only one ends up at the front. You know, the venue and the cinema is the House of Commons. And at the end of the day, very much like Hollywood controls what goes on there in a very, very hard way. They're controlled by the elites. The House of Commons is controlled by the elites.
It's true.
And they all get their messages from Davos. So what ends up seeping down is that over the long period, actually, schools, their curriculum is to give you a time management, to get up, go to work, finish, right? Your target in life is to pay off your... I used to hate, hear people get to a point when they're going to be mortgage free.
Yeah.
So your biggest ambition in life is to take a massive debt out with a bank and pay it off. and pay five times whatever your property is, right? Okay, I don't get that. I don't get that as an aim or a goal. You know, that's just a serfdom. And so the whole system is not built around you being a critical thinker.
Yep.
It's not built around you being able to... It doesn't. When I went to school, my school, we had debating competitions. And to give you the balance, so I was brilliant at debating, but that made me phenomenal at cussing. When I got back in the estate, you know, I could make friends cry. I was that, you know, like that. But that got your brain moving and how you would think. And the school system's just not set up for that. And I've worked for schools for 22 years. I've met some amazing, amazing people. The best head teachers and CEOs of trust that I've met that understand that and want to get that into their children generally get pushed out by the Department for Education. They will find things on them. I know one, set up the largest academy trust in the country, and I worked with him from one. He's still a friend of mine today. He's retired a few years. He was very entrepreneurial for a head. And he'd done a master's in business at Warwick. And he was always trying. And the other teachers, head teachers, you know, locally, oh, he's a wire boy. No, he was. He was trying to bring money into the school, additional money. It was just where he was. Their funding wasn't great. He was trying to bring technology into the school. He was trying to. He set up like a hairdresser's on site. He said so. There was kids from different. He was always
mixing
trying to do
the
something.
Two, love it.
Yeah, and his motto was world class outcomes for the children, right? But he wanted to expand their horizons so they could go and do other things other than just be a worker. And you know, he got to a point where he built the biggest academy trust in the country, and they found that a challenge. And I remember him saying to me once, because I put him on my board, because he said to me, I've done this master's in business. And I remember him explaining something to me. I said, David, that's not how it happens. Why don't you come and sit on my board? We've got Luke, you know, Luke Johnson. We've got the private equity guys, and you know, you'd be a good balance because I'm telling them stuff and they're not from that market, and you are. So it's both sides of the fence there. And
you can effectively mediate. Yeah.
And or you can offer your advice and guidance as well. And or you can just say, look, Dean's talking crap. You know, that's not how it happens. So I don't mind. I think it'd be a really good balance. And he'd said to me after 6 months, so 6 hours essentially, or a bit more, but of board meetings, he said, I've learned more about business in 6 board meetings with you and Luke and Dennis and the others who are on the board than I've learned in all the time I've been doing these businesses and all the time I've been at Warwick Studying. School. He said, it's completely pointless, but that's not how business works. And I get that. But they put so much pressure on him that they'd found out that, I mean, bear in mind, he's 70 now, that when he'd done his O-level English, he had to do it 3 times. Right.
They literally found the most tenuous reason to...
And they were going to put it in a national newspaper. You know, top head teacher in the country, couldn't pass an O-level, this, that and the other. And he just said, you know what? I was budding. He was getting close to retirement. And that's what they do. So if you're a critical thinker, you're not for that market. And I feel sorry for us. I work for a lot with a lot of trust CEOs and they're now trying to do things, but they have to almost keep it under the radar and they have to do this because... The whole country is centralised now.
Yep.
So it used to be 151 local authorities and then it was the academies programme and these are independent schools but publicly funded. Now it's 9 regional directors, commissioners. Actually, it's just centralising and it's becoming more and more totalitarian. Mm. And it doesn't matter who gets in. Starmer will just crash the bus quicker than Red Rishi will. Right? That's all it is.
It's like there's no one to trust.
There is no one, no, because they're all owned.
There's no one capable,
they're all owned.
And if they did have the idea or the capabilities, that's being quashed just like your, you know, David's ability to bring forward.
Oh, God, they'll find things out about you all the time, right? And there's something in the papers. I've seen the headlines. I don't know the content behind it. I just saw it pop up on my phone that the Conservative candidate going up against Sadiq Khan has a racist background or something. That's in the Times, right? Now, that's because the media is owned and they want Sadiq Khan to push through 15-minute cities and all the ULEZ stuff and all that because he's head of the C40. So it's all calculated. Look, Starmer and Rishi, they're two cheeks of the same arse, right? and they're controlled by the same arseholes.
That's literally the best phrase I've ever heard.
And that's what they are. So we're hearing all of this, stopping the migrants and whatever else. Well, you can't, number one, because Major signed the pact in 92 for the UN pact, and these are they label them climate change asylum seekers. It's illegal to stop them. There's 1 billion estimated to be coming in the country over the next 5 years. If you say anything, you're a racist. No, you're not, because these people, it's a misnomer. There's no illegal immigration anymore.
No.
You look at America, New York's broke now. The mayor said this week, we're broke. They get 10,000 a day. They're sleeping in the police stations. They're sleeping on the streets. Crime's gone through the roof. rape, drugs, everything. And the way I look at it is that there will be, you know, some people who really need asylum, and I'm all for that. But, you know, when you as it's 90%+ young men of fighting age, if you flee because of war, you take the women and children with you. If you go to war, you leave them behind. And that's what's happening. They're coming in, and it's orchestrated by both sides of the party. Yep. You get the lip service from Rishi. So going back to education, I think it's another bubble within the public sector. And they, you know, we all get stuck in echo chambers, and there's inertia in that public sector, and they just kind of follow through. I don't think it's full of bad people by any stretch. I'm not saying they're corrupt like the front bench MPs on both sides of the...
But their hands are tied quite often too.
But their hands are really, really tied. They've got a curriculum to deliver. In the state schools, it's all schools and the doors. The biggest difference between state and private school is mainly that you can get a more rounded child out of a private school because they get more interaction with the teachers.
The exposure.
They got longer days and they get exposed to other things. The other thing that's really big, and I've noticed when my children went to private school, and not because I had a preference, just because the local secondary schools near me weren't very good.
Yep.
Or the type of standard that I'd want to send them to, is that conversations like this. So our children could be sitting here and hearing us have a conversation. That's osmotic. They're going to learn so much about business and life and what goes on, which when I was younger, and as you were saying when you were younger, you can't get from your parents. It's not that they don't want to give it to you.
It's not their fault.
They just don't know. Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's why kids from independent schools in general, there's a lot of very tiny independent schools that do no good at all because they're not hitting any schools on the doors. It's just because of locality or kids don't want to go to the local comprehensive or whatever it is. But that's generally why they do better. Mm-hmm. When you get into the top, I don't know, 30, 40 private schools in the country, of course, there's going to be bias in the city because they went to St. Paul's or they went to Winchester, they went to rugby.
And they meet a tick list requirement. Yeah. But there is, my children both go to, you know, local, well, I say the local, similar scenario. When I first put my kids into school, we weren't in a position financially, even though both myself and my husband had really good jobs. It just wasn't viable to put them into a private school. I then decided that's what I was going to do. We started looking at it. The nearest private school to us was a 45-minute drive away. Mm-hmm. And that was not taken into consideration rush hour traffic, et cetera. And I felt like, you know, we're putting them into the local schools. Well, we had an absolute nightmare. I went to, that's where I learned to, you know, the skill set of a HR manager came in. I went to these appeals on my own to fight my kids' case because they weren't allowed into these schools and I believe that they should be. And ultimately I lost those battles and I felt like I'd failed. And then it would call it, you know, divine intervention, call it a coincidence. One of my friends said, really good school. It was we were out of the catchment area still, but they've got an advert outside saying space is available. I'm like, no, that's an oversubscribed school. Called up the school. They said, bring Owen him down. He can come and meet us. And he met them. And we were, you know, we had friends and family members who were like, why would you drive that far to take your kids to school? Change work hours around it and everything because I wanted something good for them. Yeah. And so now they both go to schools that are a fair distance. We've moved as well. So they're a huge distance from where we are. But it's that exposure that we didn't have as kids. Yeah, and even though I went to a good school, you know, it wasn't a good school. I mean, the nickname of it was the Whorehouse on the Hill.
Well, yeah, actually, the girls' version of my school I went to, that's what they used to call that as well. But whether it's true or not, it was just, I think it was just a name.
It was a nickname that was given. Yeah. I was not a whore on a hill. I should just clarify that. But I do think it's where you're saying the exposure for the kids, because little ears are always listening. And although we only moved into like an entrepreneurial world when I'm 40 now, I was 31 when we first started investing in property, but my eldest is now 13 and he's just gone into year 9. Last year we were talking about, you know, what you're going to study, etc., because he's not sure whether he wants to go to university. And, you know, when you're both mortified and proud in equal measure, and he said, well, I was thinking about studying business because he wants to come into our, IGB, into daddy's business. He said, but something along the lines of, but the business teacher in our school doesn't own his own business and he drives a Honda Civic. How can I learn from him?
There's a bit of that. My oldest lives in Dubai now. He's 22, nearly 23. He's out there doing property.
Yeah.
He's loving it. He did a business degree and about 3 years ago, we were in Dubai in October. I got a few properties out there and I was doing my residency So we spent about a month out there. Just me and him. We're not in a hotel. We rented an apartment, JBR. It was really cool. Really, really, really loved it. Great bonding. He'd do his university stuff. I'd do my online meetings, go and sort the government stuff out. I was meeting with a billionaire who owns a group of schools out there as well.
Oh, so fab.
As you do. That was, I've known him since 2003, four. Cold called him out of the blue. And
applying for the job that you weren't then qualified for?
No, I was trying to pitch him, I read about him in The Economist and as we were doing schools. And he said, come and have breakfast with me tomorrow morning. And I went and had breakfast with him in Dorchester. He flew me out to Dubai about 4 weeks later and he gave me his worldwide business.
Wow.
And my business was 3 weeks old. And 2 or 3 weeks old at the time. When I phoned him, it was 2 weeks old because we didn't have any cap. But by the time we won the account, probably a couple of months old, but we still had no business. And he bought into me, you know, that was that. So I was out in Dubai and I was listening and he's got this online, this lecturer who was wearing a Che Guevara T-shirt, right, talking about business. And Harrison said to me, don't say anything, Dad, just don't say anything, right? I was like, this chap has got no idea. Anything you're taught at university is 10 years out of date, right? And so my middle son, he A-levels in maths and economics and stuff. So he was going to go to Southampton. He had to play Southampton to really read economics and politics. And during the summer holidays last year, he's like, I'm not going. And my wife was mortified. She'd been to UCL University. When I met her, that was like just up there with Oxford and Cambridge. Again, from normal
beginnings.
Yeah. She's a very, very, very smart woman. She's just like, well, did you go to university? And I was like, no, he doesn't. I've gone 360 on it. So I'm a massive 360 on school. I think the thing is about school, it's great for socialising. It's great for interacting. I don't think you need to go to school until you're about 8 years old. And I think even then you should learn practical stuff as well. I've never used algebra since. There's lots of stuff I can't remember.
Trigonometry. No. Can't even spell it. Well, I can, but, you know.
All the elements and periodic table and, you know, used to understand how to do equations and enthalpies of reactions. I mean, I studied chemistry, physics and biology and maths after school.
If you wanted to be the neurosurgeon, I get that.
But even then. There's a lot of famous doctors out there, and there's a few I follow, and all of them say the same saying is when you leave medical practice of you're doing your 4 years or whatever, 50% of what you learn is so out of date, mm-hmm. you have to forget it, but you don't know which 50% it is. And I look at it and I think university's changed. It used to be, you know, go right back, it was about enlightenment and thinking and whatever else. Now it's indoctrination.
Yep.
It's very, very hard, left-sided. And we will get your children to think a different way. And I think that's been going on for a very long time now, that this is slow indoctrination. There's a 30-year-old study in Canada that if you send your children to preschool, right, that they're more likely to have issues in later life.
I've just watched this earlier on this morning on your... You put a story on.
Yeah. And I'd read another study on this on when they take your children out. And I think in places like Finland, you don't go to school until you're seven. So there's a big, and I read another book. It was Nature and Degenerative, something like that. It was written in the 30s. And it was about diet, how it affects the Westernizers. And they went around the world, you know, there's areas in Switzerland where they're cut off from society and they just do farming, they do education 6 months a year and they learn all these things. And they found that their brains were bigger, their skulls were thicker and stuff. The food we're being fed's killing us. Everything we're getting from school essentially drives us to be a consumer. And that's the thing. No one's talking about being an entrepreneur. I mean, Peter James has started an entrepreneur's academy. I don't know what goes on in there.
Mm.
But essentially, it should be more than that. You should have business placements. Yep. You should understand what it's like to earn your own paycheck. Not that you're a victim. You can't get a job and it's not your fault. It's their fault. No, it's 100% your fault, right? If I grew up in those situations, it's 100% my mates' faults that they couldn't do as well as they were doing, and it's 100% my fault that I ended up doing what I'm doing.
Got to take ownership whether there's success or not, because if we come the kind of full circle back to this list that you created, one of those things that you put on that list at the age of whatever it was, 20 or 21, One of them was that you wanted to be a millionaire by 30. And yeah. I mentioned you were really humble earlier on because you just skimmed over the fact that you basically set up a super successful business. You became a millionaire by 28, 29?
Yeah, paper millionaire probably by about 27, 28,
Sold on the business for an eight-figure sum. Then 30, jumped in because you skimmed over it before. You know, I was running the PLC. Like, this is huge.
Yeah. It's all accidental. None of it's by design. It just happened. We were acquired. Looking back, I should have never done a deal. I was still totally in love with my business and what I was doing. You know, no one's going to cry. You know, I had a lovely life anyway. You know, we had a lovely big house. I was 27, 28, 20. I bought my first Porsche when I was 25. I had all these things. I never really appreciated how well I was doing in comparison because you hear it all the time and it's easy to say when you've had nice things, but money doesn't make you happy. It just gives you options, Bahamas or Butlins. And that's the choices. And actually then all you're left with is memories. And I've had loads of lovely cars and I like cars.
Yeah.
But they make you happy, but they don't really make you happy. You enjoy them, but they're things.
So what really makes you happy, Dean?
These days, spending time with my family, like when we're all together.
Yeah.
So it's my wife's very social and she says, you're just not very social. but my life's spent networking. You know, I've got a massive network. If someone says to me, do you know someone who can do this? The chances are I do. And that's even by building a network. We've got a network. If you put them together, there's 3.5 billion of turnover there. So, and I've got access to these people got access to me. And, you know, that's just that multiplicity of that node network. Just so many people. But I like to be around people that are normal and I like, and I don't like to do pretentious things, you know, going like to a restaurant just because it's really expensive. Yeah. I've never been to Saint-Tropez. I've been to Antibes and Cap Ferrat and that, but with a friend, and he was like, come out and go on his boat and stuff.
But it was never on your agenda.
I'd never go anywhere where I feel like I'm being ripped off. I don't like it, that sort of stuff. So I like to be with my family and I like to be with just us. My wife always wants other people there. And I suppose a bit, you know, although she's had her own, she's an entrepreneur, she's got her own little businesses, card business and stuff. She's looked after the children, you know, always since. And that was a decision we made really early on. And luckily enough, I was in a financial position very early on. I got married at 25.
Comes back to this nurturing and support. Yeah. Is that why you believe your kids are so well-rounded?
Yeah, they are. And but then, you know, I was rounded, I think, because I went to a school where I saw other things. They're rounded that way. We've always made them work. They always do stuff. My oldest, years ago, he wanted to make some more money. So he started cleaning cars. Bought him all the stuff. Went to Halfords, I don't know, £50-60 worth of stuff. A few friends and family bought their cars round. Never again. What was that? A friend bought her husband's taxi round that hadn't been cleaned right for about 2 decades. Oh. And it ruined my drive. It cost me £1,500 to get it cleaned off my drive. But I had all these cars on the drive and he was out cleaning them. And then, so I said to him, right, you got the money. And he gave me, I was like, let's count it. So I got the money, right? And I give him some back. And I think I took about 10 or 15 quid off him. And my wife's like, what are you doing? I was like, he's taking a business loan out with me. He's got to pay it back. That's how it works.
Need to understand.
And so he had to then keep cleaning cars until he paid me back. And then he'd keep all his profit. And I said, well, so they've always understood business. They like business. He went out to Dubai to get away from anyone back home, so he'd do it on his own. My middle one, he's gone and he's working for a tech company in the city and he's already smashing all the targets.
Amazing.
Right? And he loves it. He loves his job. They love working. My daughter, many times she said, she's 17, I want to marry a billionaire. Or I need to marry a billionaire. But she does like the finer things in life. But she's probably the most entrepreneurial out of everyone.
Really?
She wanted this little electric, so I've got some really funny videos of her, little electric moped Vespa thing years ago. It was just like in the middle of the year. And I think it was like 600 quid. And it's not like I can't afford it, but it's...
She needs the lessons.
She's not having it. And I always get called, I'm soft with her and that. But, you know, I make her work for it. But I said, you can't do it. You know, you've got to save that money or maybe Christmas or whatever. And she's like, oh, I really want it now, Dad. I really want it now. She wants everything yesterday. She made this slime and then she made big pots of it. And then she put in little pots and she sold it at school for £2 a time.
Genius.
So she made some money then. And then she thought, well, I've kind of, you know, sold everyone's slime. Then she said to me, Dad, can you take me to B&M? I was like, what's B&M? I'm far too five-star these days. I said, what's B&M?
She said, did you mean F&M? Fortnum & Mason, darling?
I've got no idea. I felt like I needed to be sillet banged when I come out of there. And so she took me down to this place, and it's all like, she's like buying canned drinks and chocolates with her money. All right. So, Evie, shouldn't be eating this sort of stuff. No, I'm going to sell it at school. So anyway, she got to a point where she'd made over £1,000.
Fabulous. Right?
She bought her scooter. She was literally, we got me and my wife were laughing a few weeks ago when we was away. But I found this old video and she's driving around the drive and then down the drive and then back around. She's got her Beats on, her headphones. And she's sitting on this bike and she'd get up 45 minutes early in the morning just to drive it around.
How many kids would get up early to do something that they want to do?
But because she bought it as well, as it was her money. Someone had bought that for her, she wouldn't have been like that. She's done earrings. She done a lashes course. She was doing her friends and my wife's friends doing their lashes. The problem is she gets bored very quickly and she goes off and does, oh, no, I don't want to do that anymore. I want to do this. Now she's into
fitness. She'll set it up, but then.
Yeah, but all she says to me, she's like, got married a billionaire pop, but she says, can I work with you? She said, I don't want to work for you. Can't we set a business up together? And I'm like, yeah, we can.
I think that's an amazing thing. Yeah. And what an opportunity that you can do that for her.
Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things that you've said there is that, you know, it's your fault that you've been successful. It's other people's fault that they haven't. Yeah. And that tenacity, that drive, they're things that, you know, and they're learned skills. Because yes, people are born with it. It's either nurtured or it's not. Mm. And I just love that you encourage it, but also that it's, you know, even though she is your only girl and you could have gone, oh, she's daddy's girl, I'll get her the Vespa that she wants. We're trying to instill all of this in our kids. I've got Oliver, who's an absolute lunatic. He's the one who's, you know, being tested for ADHD. He's super smart. Mm-hmm. He gets through everything that he needs to, but he's not interested. So he'll get
the... He's not being challenged. If you see the thing that Jordan Peterson does about boys, schools can't handle boys.
Yeah.
I remember talking to... Oh, God, Barnaby Lenin. I think he was head of Harrow at the time.
He's got to be with a name like Barnaby.
Yeah, Barnaby Lenin. He's quite famous on the circuit. This was many, many, many years ago. And I was talking about exams and he was saying that boys shouldn't take any exams until they're 18 years old. They're not mature enough at 16. They're just not mature enough. Their brains don't develop as quickly as girls' brains. That's why girls do really well at GCSEs compared to boys and boys do better at A-levels compared to girls. And the way that exams are designed and all this type of stuff. GCSEs suited girls more than they suited boys. Mm. Boys are very good at storing the knowledge and coming out of it. Like my boys, I think they wouldn't study and then just go and fly through a test.
Yep, that's Oliver.
My daughter will study and study and study and get a good mark, but she's worked her ass off for it. And so there are those differences, but they don't know how to handle boys. Boys need to be challenged. They need to have lots of sport. They need to get their energy out. My brother took me boxing when I was younger, not because he wanted me to box, but he was like, you just have, actually, to be fair, my children say the same thing now. I say to my boys, do you want to come train with me? Do you want to come? And they both, my middle one's a sports scholar, you know, the older one is out in Dubai doing some boxing. He's done some Thai boxing and stuff. Nice. They all play football and rugby. And they're like, Dad, you're just mad.
don't want to train with you.
You just don't stop. You've got too much energy. And my dad, maybe I've got a hole in the adrenal glands, who knows? but my dad was the same. Like, I could take down a boxing club, but it calmed me down at school. Yeah. Stopped me being naughty and misbehaving. I was never bad. I just...
It's a management thing. Yeah. That's Oliver. So my boys do taekwondo and they've done it. Different reasons. My eldest... We took because he was the most shy and quiet. He's his dad's son. As you know, I'm not the most shy and retiring of people. And we took him, we tried him with different things. We tried him with football. He was all right, but he was never going to be the best at it. He'd done boxing, he'd done a few lessons, but we took him really young and he just didn't enjoy it. And then when he'd done taekwondo, he found his niche. Yeah. He was black striped by the time he was 9 and then COVID hit. So he could only, and that really pissed him off because he could only do training, you know. We bought him a bob so that he could do it in the house, but he couldn't grade. Yeah. So he's now a black belt at the age of 13. My youngest, he's been in taekwondo since he was 5 and 8, eligible to do it because my eldest went, but it's been the biggest blessing. They train 2 hours Monday, Wednesday, Friday, 3 hours on a Saturday morning. This weekend we'll go to a competition. Yeah. You know, he's just graded for his black stripe and just achieved it, all with A pluses. And I'm so proud of it. But he needs that because if he doesn't do that, he's bouncing the walls. Yeah. He's climbing the walls. And, you know, I don't care. We always say that Owen's going to run the world and Oliver's going to end up in prison. That's, you know, it's just a fun thing that we say. But he's not. He's going to run so many good businesses. Mm. But he'll set them up and then make other people do it for him.
My daughter was saying something to me the other day. My daughter thinks I've been adopted. she says it all the time. She says, you're just so different from... your family, from your brother and sister. I'm very different from my brother and sister. My brother works in recruitment. He's a lovely, lovely guy. He's as honest as the day is long. But that doesn't have any ambition. Just wants a nice house. A bit like my dad was.
Staying in his own lane. Yeah.
And my sister, you know, she got into a bad relationship and it didn't work out, but she's, you know, home with three kids and she was academic but didn't do anything with it, right? But again, still a lovely person. But my daughter's just like, you must have been adopted. She said, what would your parents say about you when you were younger? And I said, look, if you'd asked my parents when I was 20, out of all three children, who was gonna do well, who wasn't, I'm pretty comfortable that they'd have said that Dean's not going anywhere, right? But not in a bad way, but they would have just said, well, yeah, Edward and Angela are going to go off to university and they're going to be smart and that. And whereas Dean, he just doesn't really engage with school. I mean, I was always smart. I was in high flyer sets right up until about year nine. And then I got into this gang thing, and that was
lost
a bit sidetracked.
Well,
I got attacked on a bus on the way home. It plays on your mind when you're at school.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah, and all this type of stuff.
So your ability to concentrate disappeared.
Yeah, it was totally off. And then you kind of, you're not doing your homework, you're not doing this, that, and other. It was a bit like that. But I said to my daughter, I said, the thing is, a lot of the time, the black sheep of the family becomes the goat.
Yeah.
Right. And I said, and it's because people don't believe me. If your journey's too easy, then you've got nobody to prove wrong. Not to prove my parents wrong. You know, my parents always felt I had an inner strength. They knew I was different. Mm. And you get it harsher as the older one as well. Everything's harsh.
I agree.
I ran away from home. I, you know, stayed around friends. I sofa surfed, as they called it, for some time. Not because my parents wouldn't let me back, because I'd have blazing rounds.
You wanted the
them.
Freedom.
Yeah, because they were like, no, you need to do this, you need to do that. And so, you know, I think the thing is that with children, they need to have some resistance early on. You know, you need to make it tough. And that is you'll find it's the hardest thing compared to when you were younger, because my children, by the time my oldest was one, he'd flown more times than I'd flown by the time I was 20. You know, I didn't go on holiday till I was 18. And I paid for it myself. I'd never been abroad. I've been to Chamonix with my school on a bus skiing when I was 14.
Boss.
But it was all the way there. But that was the only time I'd really ever been abroad. And they just had a different life, you know, growing up around boats and jet skis and homes abroad. And, you know, they've got a tennis court and a garden and a swimming pool. They've got all these things. But I'm very comfortable in life now with knowing that my children are rounded enough to appreciate that's not normal.
Yeah.
Which is not unnormal, but it's just not everybody's got that. And it might be perceived a certain way that you've got certain things. But I'll talk to anyone and I'll say, well, do you know what? If you'd done what I'd done, you know, I've been a cleaner. While I was working in recruitment, I was cleaning my football club on a Sunday morning, after boxing. That would take 4 hours. I was cleaning 8 games worth of poo and wee around the toilets and mud in the clubs and stuff for 25 quid.
Right? You just did whatever it took.
I took what it took. I had a mortgage and a car. I had stuff to do. And so, I would speak to anybody who wants to challenge, you know, what I've got and what I've done. And I like Thomas Sowell's quote of, I cannot understand why it's greed to keep the things that you've worked hard for and earn, and it's not greedy to take them off and give them to someone else, right?
That's so true.
And it's so super true. Thomas Sowell is amazing. Like, if you ever want to look someone up for quotes and that, he's 92, but he's a black economist, lecturer at a university, but he's been through being a communist to a capitalist. He went through all the race riots and he's got such a worldview. I mean, he's on a spectrum. Super written loads of books, but people won't take him on TV to debate him anymore. He's just too bright. He's just too sharp. But I love him. I read his stuff.
Sounds fabulous.
Yeah, he's really cool.
And I absolutely love that about you, is that, you know, you do have a really nice life. You've built some super successful businesses. Mm-hmm. You're still doing that now. That's the thing that hasn't stopped. No. Because you do have a lovely life. You know, I don't believe there's such a thing as a work-life balance. No. I think you have to do things, you know, you do what it takes to live the life that you want to live. What's your viewpoint on the whole work-life balance?
I think if you've got to find a work-life balance, you're in a job you don't like. Mm-hmm. You know, what's the saying? If you find a job you love, you'll never work another day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, it's not that I have stress every single day. I have something goes wrong and something goes right. As long as I win more than I lose, I'm winning. And that's the way I look at it. And shit happens to everybody. It's just how you deal with it. right? And the worst thing that happens to you and the worst thing that happens to me is still the worst thing that happened to you and still the worst thing that happens to you. We feel the same pain. Someone might see them as completely different levels.
Yeah.
So what? It's about how you deal with it. It's like you go to a restaurant, they bring out a first course, it's not cooked. If they deal with it correctly and they bring you a bottle of wine and they look after you and they do all these things, then they're going to be memorable and they're going to be remarkable. So you're going to talk about them. They've dealt with a problem. People like how people deal with problems.
Yep.
But if you just have something that serves through, it's not memorable. You're not doing anything. So you're in a rut. You're doing something you don't want to do because we all need aims to go on holiday. We all get stressed whether we love our job or not, that we need a break. But my wife said it to me when I was away in Mallorca the other week. She said, the problem with you is when you're here, you want to be back home working. And when you're working at home, you're saying, I need some sunshine, right? And I've got a little office out there as well. So I work out there. She said, your brain's never in one place. You never allow yourself to relax and stuff. So, but whereas when I go to Dubai and we stay out there or we've been out on holiday, although we've got business out there and stuff, you know, I find that relaxed because everybody's still moving at the same pace.
Because that's the way it is, way of life there. Is that one of the reasons that your son's gone there as well?
Yeah,
then?
I mean, he was going there since he was, I don't know, about 7, 8 years old.
And, it's a whole different world.
It was either that or Miami. Because he worked, I'm an investor and chair in an IT recruitment business. I'm out in Miami next week for a board meeting. And he was like, oh, I could go and work out there with them. And Miami's quite a cool place. But we just weighed it up as parents and we were like, look, Dubai's closer.
Yeah.
We can see you when we're out there for stuff.
Support entrepreneurialism so much. Yeah, I've only been to Dubai a couple of times. Last time I went was only a few weeks ago and I went on my own. And I'm from Liverpool and we were talking before we came in before, you know, you hear horror stories about London. I'm from Liverpool where it is renowned for being rough, but I feel safe walking around Liverpool. I found myself kind of sitting on a tube. I'm like holding onto my handbag and I'm covering my watch because I've heard stories of people, you know, having their wrist cut off, their hand cut off to get a watch off. And I'm thinking, we went to Dubai. I turned up. I was there on my own. I turned up late and at 10:30, I was walking around the marina to go and get something to eat. And I've never felt safer. And I can totally see why so many people, I'm obviously irrespective of the taxation and all the differences around there. So,
The taxation's, what people don't weigh up about Dubai is, you know, one, it's great when you go out on a holiday or you're doing, but I like doing business out there. I love going to the meets and stuff. But I mean, it's not all great. I mean, a lot of their services, their banking and everything, it's just horrendous. I mean, I've struggled with my business banks. Yeah. Some of it's really advanced. Some of it's really, really out of date, but it's only really 50 years old as a country. But even though you might, so a friend of mine's moving back. And I said, well, he said, we love our lifestyle. We love everything. He's got business over here, but he's having problems with it. He's going to move back. He might move back to Dubai. Mm-hmm. And I said, do you have much more spare cash? You know, because your earnings is roughly the same, but one's gross and one's after you. The government have taken, the stat is in the Southeast that you end up 80% of your money goes back to the government in tax, right? Because everything's taxed. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, actually, he said that, the thing is, he said, we're quite social. He said, but food is 20-25% more expensive. Yep. They don't create anything in Dubai. Everything has to be brought in. And it's hard to get good food. A lot of it's got GMO in it and stuff like that. So my son has to go to a special place to get his grass-fed, grass-finished beef. He said, now I now pay for my kids to go to school, which I didn't do before. Mm. And it's not as much as, you know, God, at the peak when I had 3 kids, 2 boarding, it was banging on $100,000 a year to send my kids to school. That's net money after the government have nicked
whatever. After they've already took their 80%.
And they've already taken money for education there.
Yeah.
And he was saying that he's paying for that. And he said, but the thing was, he said, we're so much more social. He said, there's always something to do. There's always somewhere to go. There's always somewhere to see. And he said, and it's so much more fun. He said, but when we looked at it, we're about the same. He said,
because the disposable income was being disposed faster.
Yeah, but that's how an economy should work.
Yeah.
Right? Because they call all the trickle down effect doesn't work. It does work. I mean, there have been books written by idiots who say, oh, it doesn't work. But if you go into a restaurant and you pay, I don't know, £100 for a bottle of wine, somebody will go, well, do you know what? I could have got some Don Simon from Europe and brought that back. I don't drink wine, but you know, they could be both the same. But Someone's made that bottle, someone's made that label, somebody's brought it to your table, somebody's bought it from a wholesaler, wholesalers travelled there, but they bought it from the vineyard. All these things go on.
So like enterprise all of the way along.
And if someone's making loads of profit, if you make loads of profit in a business, it's very hard to take it out and think that's a tax efficient way of doing it. Mm-hmm. The best thing is just reinvest in your business or invest in another business, be a wealth generator, give people jobs, give them hope, give them aspirations, give them a career ladder. And that's what people don't get here. They all look at, if you think the government's the answer, then you're asking really the wrong questions.
Absolutely.
Right? Because the government, all the government wanted to be is that this government now is the biggest government we've ever had. And it's a Tory government. Tories used to be about low tax, small government. And this one's about more tax. And they've got 1/3 of all the workforce in this country works for the public sector. So a lot of people, when you come to masking and this, that and the other, that will do as they're told because mm-hmm. their jobs depend on it. It's not really their fault. They've got to do it. The government needs to be cut up. You know, social services is one of the worst performing.
What's the answer, though?
Because I've got loads of answers. They're not going to happen because it's quite a big job. But they need to weed out anyway. Basically, you should if you started with a couple of things. If you cancelled everybody who went to Davos, right, and said anyone who goes to Davos, a private club. When you look at the memorandums and articles of association in Switzerland, only a Klaus Schwab family member can run that. It's a private organisation that we fund and all these different businesses fund and these billionaires and actors. You think they're getting together to talk about your good? Right? It's absolute rubbish. And then you say, right, okay, well, you know, debt can only be 5% of GDP. Right. Okay. And if you can't keep it there, then you lose your job. Right. You'd find the monetary commissions were getting it right. You'd find that they weren't just pandering to the banks, bailing them out.
Because there's a rule in there that, yeah, do you know what? I'm voting Dean Kelly for Prime Minister. Would you ever go into politics?
I thought about it. Loads of people said that to me. Obviously, I've got a bit of a. I've not got a criminal record or anything, but I've got a past which I don't know. But my wife's always said, "Don't." Andrew Sillitoe tried to get me to write a book. And my wife said, I don't want the children knowing how you grew up. Right? And now they know, they're a bit older anyway. I don't know. I think it's a bit of a thankless task because you'd eventually have to compromise on what you were doing to get where you are. And someone like me, you know, I don't know, they call you mad right wing, mad left wing, conspiracy theorist, whatever else. You just get picked apart by the MSM. Not that I think long content now, like podcasts, is where people are at with this type of stuff. And I think people are more open to it. But yeah, it's something people say to me all the time, you should go into politics. I don't know whether I want that attention. You know, you talked about sitting in the background earlier. Gary's big, gregarious character. He's out there doing all this stuff. I don't do it. I like talking and doing podcasts and getting a message out there, but it's nothing in me wants to be famous. So I wouldn't be doing it for narcissistic reasons.
One of the few who aren't.
Yeah. But I'd be doing it for passion and change.
Yeah.
And for my children and other people's children. I had someone say to me a while back when I was kicking off about something, you know, one of these the things they're bringing in with carbon credits and stuff like that. He said, what do you care? You can afford to buy carbon credits. You can afford to do this, that, and
that's irrelevant.
That's what I said. And I said, but then you're like everybody else. You're saying, well, it's someone else's problem. I said, what about Dean when Dean was 10? Dean's parents couldn't afford to buy carbon credits. I said, what about all the other deans that are out there? I said, you know, I'm looking after, what about, you know, my children, my children's children? I don't know that they're going to do well, you know. My money could all, you know, I've got loads of investments. I invest loads of money. It could all go pop tomorrow. And there's a big chance that the banking industry will go pop in the next 2 years, right? So there's all these things going on. And I'm like, well, why wouldn't you care about the future?
Isn't that what's wrong with the world, is that people are focusing on just their own little bubble? I'm all right, Jack. What I absolutely love about you, and I don't even think it is for you as the person that it's, you know, I've come from humble beginnings and I've seen all sides of it. Mm. I think it's that one thing that theme that has run all of the way through this is that you genuinely care. You genuinely care about people. Yeah. You're doing good in the world. You're helping because the businesses that you've set up, it's yes, they're all lucrative. They're all making money. But the theme through all of them is how many people you can help in the education sector, in the recruitment sector, how many people you bring in together in the network. Mm-hmm. So I suppose my next question, I'm very conscious of your time. My next question is, what's next for you?
I've got some really decent businesses. I've got one that's a challenge. It's a SaaS business because I think the perception from the other side is that, oh, how's it making money and what's it say? But I've seen how I believe I can save schools about 150 million a year to 250 million a year. This is the case of this, right? I put a presentation to Hertfordshire. I'll say that because it all went pear-shaped. But just before COVID, Hertfordshire County Council, they run a thing called Hearts for Learning. It used to be called Teaching Hearts. I actually started Teaching Hearts in 2002. Wow. They just nicked the name. And it was about managing their recruitment. They call themselves a private company, and they're not. They're just basically you outsource education services. And I'd spoke to the CEO. He's not the CEO anymore. And I basically, I'd worked with them, the HR director and some others, and I put a proposal together. Now, I was going to save, and this wasn't taken in all of their schools, I was going to save them £2.2 million over the next 2.5 years across Hertfordshire in the school's budget. I would be able to put £250,000 back into central services. So it's a social enterprise. We're running JVs, putting special purpose vehicles together. So there's skin in the game for the people who like that. So there's reasons for them to use it and get that economy of scale they can't get on their own. And we went quite far into this, right? They had a CTO, you know, come out of BT and really didn't know his arse from his elbow. But, we could build it then. You know, everyone can copy a business, but it's execution that counts.
We can build it, we don't need you.
Yeah, there was a little bit from him. He was new in there. I put him on a spot for a couple of things and he couldn't hold his own. The head of, I think it was director of recruitment or human resources at the time, we got to a point where we were just about to do more meetings. It was going to be in April, and in March, COVID closed it all down. But I'd got an email from him saying, at that time, we're not going to be back in school. We're not going to be back in the building until 2023. This is 2020. So talk about organised already, right? And that was March 2020. He sent me that email. But we have concerns. In schools, you have like someone's, I don't know, sometimes it was primary school, it might be someone's mum sat there who's booking the supply teacher coming in the morning, right? Or secondary school, it might be somebody's doing a part-time job doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Or a lot of the time, it's someone on 20, 25 grand a year doing that, just booking supply teachers, which is, you could put another NQT, newly qualified teacher, or TA into a classroom.
And save a fortune.
Yeah.
And have consistency.
Yeah.
Have another child, you have five teachers in 1 year in that same instance.
That's the big thing. And that's because a lot of them are mismanaged in what they're doing. They don't understand recruitment. Just because they're surrounded by people, they think they understand it. They don't understand onboarding, retention. Retention's an intrinsic factor, not extrinsic. That's why they always say it's about money. It's not. It's absolutely not. And I put this in front, and he said, because we're worried we might upset some people in the schools because it'd be a change of behaviour for them and they might think they're losing their job. And I was thinking, well, some of them could lose their job and you'd still be better off and you'd be saving money and stuff. So the protectionism and the inertia for change, they might be out there shaking their fists saying, well, we want more money, we want this, that and the other. But actually, they had £4 million in cash in their accounts, which they're getting funding from the school's money. And I'm like, looking at it thinking, this is what's wrong. You've got people who
aren't business minded.
They've got no idea. My first meeting with them, they double booked the meeting room in this county office. I'd gone in to see them. There was four of them. We ended up doing it in a canteen, right? Very noisy. I'm trying to shut it up. I had a cold at the time, a bit of sinusitis going on. So it was like very hard to hear them. And doing all that. And it was, I think it was about quarter to four at the time. And two of them were looking at their watch all the time. And they were like, oh, well, we finish at 5, but I like to get out by 4 because then miss the rush.
Therein lies the problem.
Yeah. And that unfortunately is the problem mainly with councils. But the whole sector. So I've got that. Sorry for a long-winded answer.
No, I'm loving this.
I think that's a good thing. I think we can save schools a lot of money. I've got a few education businesses that I think will grow. Got some other businesses. I think the thing is, I'm enjoying doing that, advising people that generally I invest in. So yeah. I don't really do anything outside of that. I love working with my RDLC. Like I run something yesterday on how to improve margins and value propositions, etc., with 40 CEOs. So I do that.
How much you enjoy it, and you really get a buzz from
you've
it.
Got all that experience. I mean, you do talking on stage about property. But if you just do it for yourself, that's fine. You can make some money. You can be good at what you do. But I'm one of these people who I live an ancestral diet and stuff like that. I believe in this hereditary heuretics where you hand down information to people. And what's the point of keeping it? That's what the elders used to do and whatever else. And I see myself as, right, okay, I might not be the oldest, but I'm getting there. I'm going to hand on the information. I really enjoy doing that. Next week I'm running, I've got a lunch in London. I've got 40 CEOs in there on how to build a business to sell, how to raise finance, the different options in terms of either listing your business or taking on private equity debt or, you know, doing something with your employees. There's very different ways of doing that. So I do that and I like that.
Yeah.
And I like that sort of stuff. So I get a lot of fun out of that. And I want to be able to always have the freedom to say, if I want to go on holiday with my family, I can do. If I want to do this, I can do. I'm going to Miami for a board meeting and then I'm off to Colombia for stem cells in my spine and my shoulders and my knees.
Because you're training too hard.
You're training too hard. I've got the luxury of being able to do that, just being going away and doing that. So I don't know what's next.
You've also worked your backside off for it.
I don't think I'd ever stop. My wife says she'd divorce me if I retired.
Because she wouldn't know what to do with it. Do you know what? Yeah. I interviewed Neville Wright a couple of days ago. He's 73. He's still, you know, we were talking and he was like, I've got £120 million worth of property in the pipeline right now. And he's showing me his injuries where he's still there doing the doing. Yeah. I said, why do you do it? He said, I've got kids, I've got grandkids, I've got great grandkids. And one day I'm going to die and I want to die the fittest man and fittest in my mind because I'll never stop. And I think that's what's wrong with a lot of people is, you know, work to a certain point. I want to achieve X, Y, or Z. And they do. You could have very easily stopped at the age of 30 when you reached your goal of being a millionaire, but it's always moving the flagpole in the sand.
Money's just, it's like if you play sport, a good friend of mine who's sold a business, made loads of money. And he did a talk for me the other week. And he said one of the biggest lessons he ever got taught was if you play the game properly and you do it well, the score will take care of itself. Right. And it's very true. If you just aim for money, you're probably going to be very envious and jealous and whatever else. If you aim for a bit of legacy and to be good at something, you'll get the medal, right? Mm. You'll get the medal. How much money that is, there's some lines of work, you're just never going to make that much money. Some lines of work, you'll make loads of money. But that's not the comparison. Right? There's always someone rich and there's always someone poorer. That's really not the comparison. It's, you know, happiness isn't how much money.
It's an inside job, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's about where you are as a person. Do you feel comfortable with yourself? Do you feel comfortable with your surroundings and the people there? You know, if I left the room, what would people say about me? Mm. That sort of stuff. And because you don't want to be that rich person who, when he's gone, everyone's like, oh, what an arsehole.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't want to be like that. And the one thing I've never, ever actually been a millionaire. When I put down I was going to be a millionaire by the time I was 30, it wasn't because I was desperate to be a millionaire. It's because I needed to get 10 things down. And that was one of them.
No way. It was just like there's a space on the page.
Because I remember speaking to my mum and dad and I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. Millionaire. Because obviously back then £1 million was a lot
huge,
more money.
Huge, yeah.
Right, you know, and anyone who was a millionaire would have this. I remember when I started earning over six figures, I was about 23. And I'd stopped fighting, but I was still training and sparring. I'd been boxing training on a Friday night. And I went and met my friends in the local bar. I mean, I didn't even really drink then either. They just turned up and they'd bring me a cappuccino and my mates would have a Stella. And we were talking, and I'd got a BMW convertible as a company car. They'd given me this company car to help hunt me from another company. I'll be 24, I think. And my mate was like, where'd you get that car? I was explaining the situation. And one of my friends, I'd got him a job in recruitment. So once you've been exposed, you understood there were people who earned good money. And he could know how many contractors I had out, the kind of people I was working with, the margins I'd be on, the sector I was in. You could do the maths and get to a rough number. Right? And my mate, he was just going at me all the time. How much money are you earn? How much money are you earn? How much money? I was like, I don't really want to talk about it. It's Friday. Everyone's still got pay slips. It was the end of the month. And then I went to the toilet, came back, and my mate Simon said to my mate, he said, he reckons you're earning about 100 grand a year. And I was like, probably a bit more than that. And he's like, no way. And he said, what, 110, 110? And I said, I don't know. I said, pro rata, it might be 130, 140 at the moment. But but the way the contracts work, it's just going to go up. And he looked at me and he went, fuck off. If you were earning that much money, you'd have seven-bedroom house and three Ferraris. And I said to him, why do you think that? And he said, because that's how much. And he was on 12 grand digging holes in roads. You know, and it's the comprehension.
Yeah.
I remember ringing my dad up and saying, the biggest paycheck I'd had at the time, I said, I paid £27,000 in tax this month.
What an achievement.
Yeah, my dad was just silence. And he was like, it's a lot of tax. And it was a bit like that. But he can't get his head around it.
Yeah.
And I only spoke to him because no one else cares. Right, and I wanted to speak to someone because I couldn't believe it either. I just did.
It's a massive achievement. Like,
yeah. But I didn't spend it. I was kind of just carried on working. The more I earned, the harder I worked. But that gave me the money to start my first business.
Yeah,
and that was it. So I just saved up the money and done that. So long answer to what's next. Just more of the same. Enjoying life. Keep, you know, I'm going to win some. I'm going to lose some. I'm going to keep investing in businesses. Keep working with people. That's my big thing. I like being around people, working with people.
So evident. So one question that I always ask my guests is, and I'll finish on this one, I'm conscious of your time, is what is the one question you've never been asked but you wish someone would? Or what is the one subject matter that nobody ever discusses and you really want to?
I've got loads of subject matters my wife tells me never to discuss because unfortunately, people ask me a lot of questions. I'm a go-to person. When we go on holiday, my wife hates it. She says, don't talk business anymore. And someone will talk COVID, and I talk COVID. And then they'll talk World Economic Forum. And then they'll talk history. They'll talk about Prussia and the First World War. And I'll get into everything because I hate not knowing. So yeah. I read and read and read and read. I suppose more part in terms of one thing I wish people would discuss was how they really feel, right? And have no fear of retribution, being cancelled or whatever else, because that's not freedom of speech. Anybody's banning books or banning news or banning any content or whatever, unless it's horrendous stuff like, child stuff and whatever. But, you're never on the right side of history. And so people need to start saying, well, actually, I don't agree with this. Because I think with loads of stuff, trans and everything, I think you're talking about the 0.01% of people that are controlling everybody else's narrative. Yeah. And I just wish if people were going to talk about something, they could be honest and say, how do you really feel about that? Right. And that would be the question for me for everybody. How do you really feel about that? Not how your boss or your working environment or your demographic wants to feel about it. How do you feel about it? Because I think you'd find that actually more people are united on what they believe than they're not. But the powers that be want you divided because you divide and conquer.
Yeah.
And that's my big issue at the moment. I think people should come together. It doesn't matter your backgrounds or whatever, what your sexual orientation is. I don't need to know that.
It's irrelevant.
Yes, completely irrelevant. Look, if your sexual orientation or your race is the biggest thing about you, then you really need to check your life out for something better to talk about, because you need to have a more fulfilling life, right? Because that doesn't define you.
Filling a void somewhere else.
Yeah. So, look, I just think, if people were more honest in general, my wife says you're brutally honest sometimes. But if you're not going to lie and you're not going to tell people the truth, sometimes you have to soften it. But
it's the way it's delivered, isn't it?
Yeah, just be more honest with yourself, Just how do you really feel?
What a lovely note to finish the podcast on. Thank you so much for being my guest. We're going to put all of the details in the show notes for anyone to follow you, because I am certain that there will be people who now want to do exactly as you've done or learn some more from you. So we'll put that all in the show notes. Thank you so much for being my guest.
That's all right. Thank you for inviting me.